giant pothole. Over on.
Green-eyed lady, lovely lady, strolling slowly towards the sun.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. And I want to thank, you know, the Grave Digger and for really connecting us with the Pro Football Hall of Fame's Leroy Butler. And, you know, I had the pleasure of having Leroy on when I was on a different radio station. We would have him on from time to time. We became really good friends and hadn't talked to him in a while, but it's really good to have reconnected with him. Thanks to Gilbert Brown. But it's Monday, and it's I can't say under the helmet with Sandy Williams, can I?
I don't know what kind of a helmet that would be.
It's good to see you, Sandy.
I should wear a helmet in case I fall down.
Well, I don't know if we...
Yeah.
It's good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you. Beautiful weather,
apparently. Yeah, so how did the crew go?
Well, I was in Cincinnati. The Midwest Championship for youth rowing was there, and the Milwaukee... Proud to say that the Milwaukee Rowing Club, which is the only, it's the high school rowing organization. There's just one of them, and we compete against other cities. But they did, the boys and girls both did really well, and we got four boats going to the Nationals. That's never happened before, so.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah.
Must have been a lot of excitement.
Well, it's exciting. You know,
These are high school kids.
These are high school kids, yeah. And
families
and
they work
really, really hard. The training regime for rowing is year-round and harder work than you can imagine. So these kids are in terrific shape, and they put a lot into it, so it's great they get something like this back.
Family support?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, the spectator rowing is not, but it's not baseball.
Right.
It's not basketball in terms of fan support. But, all parents and the audience is filled with all the parents,
right,
from everywhere, And so these are teams from Cincinnati, St. Louis, Texas, all over the Midwest. So it's a lot of boats and they did, it was exciting.
So when you talk about crew and I think about needing upper body strength, but you probably get a lot of that power from your legs, right?
It is legs. You sit on a seat that slides back and forth. And so, yeah, everyone thinks about people pulling with their arms and their upper body, but actually rowing is all about leg strength. I mean, it's the upper body too, but it's interesting. Rowing and cross-country skiing are apparently two of the hardest exercises in terms of combining strength and endurance.
Congratulations. I know that none of these things happen without hard work. You know, any of those kind of things, commitment by the guys, and some of them will take this on to the next level, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got boys and girls going on to college and rowing. Many of them go to college, get into the college they get into because of their rowing. We've got a big-time venture reaching out into the community that can't otherwise afford it. So we have kids from those families as well who have been able to both get involved with rowing but now go to schools with scholarships.
But when you say afforded, I'm trying to think what cost could be associated with the rowing.
Traveling,
yeah.
Yeah. They don't have to pay for equipment, but they have to pay,
right.
They have to pay for traveling. And we have professional staff, and so the professional staff needs to get paid.
Right. Well, anyway, congratulations.
Yeah, well, they did it.
Coaches play a role in these things.
And we get more out of it than the kids get from us. But it's like, as you know, from football.
So Sandy, what, man, G7 summit conference, a lot of conversations. Russia and China have decided that this whole conversation was against us or about us, and they're ramping up their thoughts and they're about us.
It wasn't a secret that it was about them. It was announced that one of the purposes of the meeting was to figure out how to put a harness on China economically and how to deal with Russia with further sanctions. So, the meeting was all about them. But... So it wasn't paranoia. So, the good news for you is you're not paranoid because it's actually happening.
But we need to comprehend as Americans that when there's, and they weren't there to sing Kumbaya, right?
Right.
They're there to say, well, these are things that we see that could be a threat. Global threats is what they're talking about.
Well, the problem is, I think, that we Americans get our news, and largely now it's a news media that's not funded enough to do its work independently, so it takes its news releases from our government and reports it to us as real news. So, for instance, we look at the G7 meeting through the prism that is presented to us by American news media, right, which is in large part presented to them by the American government. And the rest of the world looks at it through their own prism and differently, right? So, in fact, I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and interestingly, Meta is the company that owns, I believe, Facebook. And Meta was just fined $1.5 billion by the European Union with respect to the regulatory body that regulates internet. And the reason they were fined that is because Meta, contrary to the rules of the European Union, was sending essentially its surveillance data, the data that it had about its customers in Europe, back to the United States, contrary to the rules of the European Union, because the European Union does not want European citizens to be subject to the surveillance of the United States government. Meta is subject to surveillance rules under the U.S. from the U.S. government. So doesn't this sound a lot like the Americans and being worried about China and the Chinese programs? And so, we're busily worrying about China. The rest of the world is kind of worrying about us.
Sandy... I've known about the G7 for a long time. For people who don't know, what is the G7?
Well, it's supposedly the seven biggest economies in the world. And for a while, Russia was part of the G7, and they were asked to
sit. Well, China is one of the big – why are they not one of the G7? I mean, it does say something, right?
Yeah, I mean it's the Western economy was the original G7, though. It's the seven biggest Western economies.
So let me ask you, Sandy, while we're sitting there and this is going on, I got to tell you, many years that I've heard about the G7, have I not really been interested in what they talked about, because maybe this time around it's because of Ukraine and Russia, and I knew that it was something I had to pay attention to, and so I paid more attention to it this time around than ever before. And I got to tell you, Sandy, some of the things that were being discussed and talked about openly clearly were pointing the finger at, we've got to prepare ourselves for Russia and China. And how do you say those things publicly, Sandy, without Russia and China saying, you pointed your finger at us as being a threat to world security and safety? How do those nations, Sandy, take that kind of public, doctrine, basically, about the two two of the other most powerful nations on earth. You bring them together, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I just looked up G7 because, to be honest with you, you stumped me a little bit. And it's kind of an arbitrary group. It started a while ago. It must have been the biggest economies that were tightly linked to one another. It's Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, United Kingdom, and the United States. So it obviously leaves out Korea and a number of other big economies, Korea, China, and some very truly big economies. So it's a historic vestige to some extent. And you know, I was talking about PRISM before because, you know, we talk very aggressively about taking steps to contain China, for instance. And then we wonder why China talks aggressively about worrying about the United States and its aggressiveness. It's kind of mind-boggling. If you try and step back and look at the conduct of the Western nations objectively, it seems like a group of people who and governments, and particularly our government, who have a lot of hubris, we think we can talk expansively and aggressively and not expect a reaction from the rest of the world.
So, Sandy, here's what in keeping with what you just said, not more than several weeks ago, the United States came out publicly and said we want to kind of draw back the conversation and we want to build relationships back with China. A couple weeks ago, that conversation was being had.
Yeah.
And then you turn around at the G7 and you're talking about the opposite of that, Sandy.
Well, we act like we're in an economic war, so, you know, like currently Russia and Ukraine have to talk with a lot of bravado about how it is that they aren't interested in talking about peace, you know, and they're fighting on the ground, and the stipulation they have for talking about peace seems like stipulations that could never lead to peace because it's all about posturing.
Yeah, but Sandy,
so we're busily posturing in the world, apparently, with our economic rivals posturing in a manner that sounds like we're involved in an economic war.
But this is not public theater. This is high stakes, right?
Right. And my problem with economic war is that historically, mercantile rivalries that develop into heated contests with tariffs, et cetera, tend to heat up all the way to
real war. Yeah. Got to go to a break. Phone lines are open, 844-967-2789. It's Monday with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. You know, lovers free. At 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And I'm sorry, Sandy, that we're just jumping right into it. What is happening now is moving so fast with Ukraine and the involvement with Russia and Ukraine and the G7 and the United States that, you know, we haven't been talking a lot about it, but this escalates things, right?
Well, certainly being involved with training the pilots for F-16s, taking our finger off the lever and saying, yeah, you European Union countries, NATO countries can send F-16s to Ukraine if you choose. All of that is obviously an escalation. I think the real issue is, and Russia declares that it could be a huge escalation. It could be a big problem. We don't know whether Russia's referencing accidents that could happen as the result of F-16 fighters releasing missiles that exceed the boundaries of Ukraine, or what kind of a red line Russia's drawing when they say that. My hope is, I always hope, that the secret back channels have clarified things for our White House to understand what level of risk they're undertaking. But I've come to learn that our intelligence agencies aren't necessarily as sound as we all would hope they would be. They've certainly caused us a lot of trouble over the last 35 years, and maybe even longer, all the way back to Vietnam. So I think it's troublesome. I think what's troublesome is the fact that we are being fed this news that is biased. So, you know, up until today or yesterday, we were being fed news that Bakhmut was on the verge of being retaken by Ukraine, that Ukraine was winning this battle and winning that battle, that Russia was losing all of its men, that Russia's military reserves were being exhausted, that the Wagner forces were going to retreat from Bakhmut. And all of this was contrary. If you tried to read both sides' propaganda, the propaganda being presented by the other side was that and with maps showing the location of the Ukrainian troops and the Russian troops, and a declaration earlier this last week that Bakhmut would fall this weekend, and a map showing just how untenable the position of Ukraine was. That news ended up being much more accurate than what we were hearing. So I'm confounded and worried about the fact that we're involved. Like I said, when the war began, when war starts, truth ends. But I'm afraid that we're further from the truth than we should be as a third-party country and as a population, a domestic population, that is being asked to absorb, you know, over $100 billion of an outflow of our cash to Ukraine, and we're getting fed information that just isn't straight.
So why is Bakhmut just such an important area?
Well, everyone scratches their head. There is a highway that goes through Bakhmut. It does seem to have some logistical importance in terms of being able to supply troops that might be beyond Bakhmut. If for Russia, it would be supplying troops that have penetrated Ukraine further than that's. We got wind here. It's a loud noise. That have penetrated Ukraine further than Bakhmut. So it's a logistical support potentially, and then it became symbolic. And frequently in wars, we can go back to World War I and Verdun and place. We can name places that were actually just of symbolic importance, became symbolic. A place where you decided that you would try to exhaust the enemy. And exhaust their troops, and that's what Bakhmut became, I think.
So there are these differing signals. Zelensky again stated that our goal is to regain all of our territory, all of it.
Yeah,
and you have constantly stated that Crimea was not going to be a part of that, and the United States was not going to support that. But he continues to say, Zelensky, all of it. Our goal is to take back
our Secretary of State said several months ago that the United States was not enthusiastic about the notion of throwing and contesting Crimea. And I think that our action in 2014 when Russia took Crimea and we sat on our hands was symbolic of the fact, emblematic of the fact that the United States at some level understood that Crimea and Sevastopol were very critically, strategically important to Russia as they had been critically, strategically important to the Soviet Union.
So what Zelensky is asking for, it may not be altogether what the United States is prepared for or willing to support him totally in. Is it safe to say that?
I think it's safe to say that. And I think the issue then becomes, like in a war, in order to secure a better negotiating position, maybe Ukraine needs to put the Crimea at risk to Russia, you know, militarily at risk to Russia, so that they come to the bargaining table where then Crimea could be conceded. But is that what's going on, or is it something else? And there is certainly within Ukraine a nationalist movement that basically is strident about saying we'll be satisfied with nothing less than regaining all of Ukraine's territory as it was established in 1991.
You know, Sandy, there's more to all of this than meets the eye. And Joe Biden has just agreed to another $325 million in financial support and aid. And as you stated, we continue. This is continuing at a time when we're talking about debt limits.
Yeah. We've
got to go to break. Hold the thought. 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
Just a little more time. Just a little more time. And my love will surely grow. Baby, give me just a little more time. Just a little more time. And my love will surely grow.
To the early evening show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Let's go to the phone lines and Gary from Sussex. Hey, what's going on, Gary?
Hey, welcome back. I missed you last week.
Well, thank you. I miss you guys.
Okay, I got a comment for Sandy, and I like listening to Sandy. I really look forward to having him on because I think he's really smart and he's got a good point of view, and I think he's pretty much kind of in the middle.
And sucking up to him is not going to, he can't really give you anything.
Ooh, I'm worried about what happens after Brett.
No, Sandy. I do like listening. I learn a lot. I mean, I'm a conservative. I listen to Fox and I listen to CNN. I listen to you guys all the time, so I do learn a lot, okay? But I do disagree 100% of what Sandy said before about Crimea, that in 2014, Obama was president when Russia came into and took Crimea. You kind of made it sound like, well, we really didn't want to get involved, and, you know, we know that the Russians need that and everything else. Well, So does Ukraine need that. The fact is, Obama, he went out there and he said, don't you dare go into Crimea. And then they went a little bit in and he said, look, I'm drawing a line in the sand. You cross that line and you guys are looking for getting in a big fight with us. And he told them not to go in. And they did anyways. And as far as I'm concerned, he was weak because he made a point that don't you dare cross this line. I'm drawing a line in the sand, and he didn't follow through on it. So
I think you're confusing the red line that he drew in Syria with the Crimea situation, but because my memory is befuddled by the notion that there was any sort of line drawn by Obama with respect to the invasion of Crimea. In fact, I think it was. It was a newsworthy event, but not terribly newsworthy, because I think our government had decided to take an economic sanctioning approach to it in the hopes that economic sanctions might keep it from happening, but that was the limit of our willingness to be involved.
And quite frankly,
there was no defense of Crimea by Ukraine. You can't say there was actually a war over Ukraine. It took approximately 48 hours for that process.
Right, but Obama did say you cannot come in there. I mean, if you just go on the internet and you can read it all over the place that he was against it, but he didn't follow through as far as I'm concerned.
Gary, let me ask you. For people like you who say that we're not doing enough, how far should we go? President Biden just said the other day that, you know, there are limits of what America can do, at least we wind up in World War III. Your thoughts?
I have no idea what we should do over there.
Okay,
I know, but the thing is this. I don't believe that we should turn our back on Ukraine, but the fact is...
Like, we haven't turned our back
before,
on
it. I know that, but the fact is, you've always said, and I agree with you, both you guys, how many billions of dollars are we going to give them? You know what I'm saying? But the fact is, you know, we got to show Russia that they're not going to become the Soviet Union again. These are sovereign countries, and they have their freedom, and we don't want the Soviet Union around at all anymore. And, you know, so I believe that we have to stand behind these guys. But how many billions of dollars are we going to give them?
Well, I mean, but budget? You know, you said something there that, you know, we have this interest in what happens in all of these disputes around the world, but we have not gotten involved in boundary disputes in many places. There's an ongoing serious boundary dispute between between China and India with respect to some land up in the high mountain area. There have been significant issues in, for instance, Ethiopia and Eritrea, which we have ignored. And the collapse of the Soviet Union was something that we didn't really participate in, and which we were astonished by, quite frankly.
And benefited.
Did we benefit or not? We cheered about it at a time when the people in the collapsing countries experienced an extreme depression. You know, not only did their government fall apart, but their economies fell apart, and they were in free fall. And so, you know, what happened to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the return of the eight republics that had comprised it was something that we watched, something that happened to our surprise, something that seemed to happen gracefully without warfare. But I think we're still involved with the echo of that. That was a cataclysmic event, and we should have been willing to understand that there would be serious potential conflicts and outcomes that would be derived from it. And this seemingly graceful transition from Soviet Union to eight republics was not going to be something that would continue without some echoes, some historical echoes. And that's surely what's happening right now. And to some extent, it was we've accelerated it, or at least thrown some grease on the fire with our actions in terms of expanding NATO. So, you know, and expanding NATO is being done for the very reason you're describing, I guess, which is a declaration that the sanctity of these independent republics is going to be protected with all of our wealth. I mean, we have now put Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, they're in NATO. And so were there to be a military incursion into those countries, we would be at war. We, the United States, would be at war. We're as committed to going to war over those places as we are to defending the state of Maine, were it to be invaded.
So, Sandy, I want to quarrel with something Gary said. We don't want to see the Soviet Union back. We, the United States, as if the United States runs the world. And it is that thought process, Sandy, I think, that keeps all of these things on an uneasy platform. The rest of the world and Russia is saying, and if I'm in Russia, I'm like, you can't dictate to me. What makes it in a free world, Sandy?
Yeah, I think, I mean, Russia is even more concerned because there have been documents that were either released or leaked that indicated that ever since the Wolfowitz period and the neoconservative period, the United States has been talking about strategies that would cause not only the Soviet Union, these countries to remain independent, but for Russia itself to collapse in the same manner that the Soviet Union collapsed, which is to talk about a sovereign country. It would be as if as if Russia was in its government, at government levels, talking about carrying out policies that would help California secede or Texas right. secede. You know, there are secessionist conversations in these various states. What if foreign countries began to participate in that?
So if you hear, like, or read what I was reading about Joe Biden and his conversation with Zelensky this past weekend about those F-16 fighter jets, and Biden asked Zelensky, or told him, you can't use those to attack Russia. And Zelensky said, oh, no, I won't, we won't. And even just that, because of what the F-16 will be able to do to those Russian troops that are in Ukrainian territory, that clearly points a finger of escalation if you're Russia.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There seem to be unwritten rules associated with proxy wars. And apparently it's okay to give armaments that make it much more difficult for the people on the ground in each country to survive and to succeed. That's okay. But if you create two things. One, if you give weapons that can provide the opportunity to offensively attack the foreign ground of the like, for instance, Russia's the aggressor here.
Right.
But clearly we have drawn a line in the sand that says we will not do anything that will help Ukraine
go into Russia.
And so our HIMARS rockets were constrained in the distance in which they would go. We've given them surface-to-surface missiles that have limited range to very much make it harder for Ukraine to reach very deep into Russia, if ever, with the weapons we might give them. I think the second red line is to give weapons that would have serious strategic advantage for one side. And I suspect that F-16s and getting air superiority, or at least getting the capacity to more clearly control the air over Ukraine, might be viewed as that kind of a problem.
I got to say to you, Sandy, and our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can join the conversation. Sandy, is it anti-American to say that even though America's not going to be providing these F-16s, to think that we can convince the other nations to provide these expensive planes, mm-hmm. and at some point in time, we're not going to financially or do something to...
Well, I don't know. There's two. In terms of America and what America ought to do, what we ought to be doing is evaluating our strategic interest very carefully. And we ought to be calculating what it is that is actually strategically important to America and the American people.
I thought we've been doing that.
With Ukraine?
No, yeah, I'm saying...
Well, you and I have been talking about it and hoping that the United States government would evaluate what our real strategic interests are, because the way we currently are evaluating it has us spending over $900 billion a year on our military defense budget. And so that's a drain that we as an economy, but we as a people can't socially afford. We could afford it financially, apparently, but it's coming at the expense of programs for the people that might improve the lot of the American people materially.
You know, Sandy, even bigger than that, the thought of putting Russia behind the eight ball, watching the F-16s destroy their troops that are disconnected to Russia, and maybe get them to finally say,
well, I think the dynamics of the air, the view of the war originally was that the military strategists looked at the attack and said Russia will attain air superiority over Ukraine almost immediately, and the war will only last for weeks in that circumstance. But it ended up that the surface-to-air defense of the Ukrainians, as well as their limited Air Force capability, was much greater than people had imagined.
And then our support.
And so Russia, well, but no, in the first weeks of the war, they didn't have our support.
Right.
But they had this capacity, and their surface-to-air defenses were Western provided, some of it, and some of it was Soviet, the old Soviet systems, but they were much more effective than people had expected. Russia did not get air superiority, and that's what prolonged the war. And now we're sort of getting inch by inch back into the war. The air defense system of Ukraine has been strained mightily by all these missiles, etc. And so I think the F-16s are there because the surface-to-air defense capacity of Ukraine has been compromised.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. The Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. So, Sandy, what's going to happen with the debt ceiling? I mean, they're going to work it out. Clearly, they have to work it out, right? There's no scenario you can see that they don't work it out.
Well, other than idiocy.
well, Sandy, they're not going to even, no idiot is going to allow the debt ceiling to erode.
Do you promise?
I mean, even if Joe Biden has to give
Look,
in.
Look, this whole flirtation with it is probably going to result in another downgrade of our federal Treasury financial credit rating. It did last time around, and it's probably going to happen again because we can't seem, you know, we didn't learn our lesson. We don't learn our lessons. And we have to solve for this so that this does not become just this biennial political football that it has become. And we have to start talking sensibly about it. Unfortunately, when we get to this point, both sides just recite their party lines. You know, we don't have any talk about increasing taxes. We don't have any talk about reducing defense expenditures. We don't have any talk about what you would talk about in a family if you were going to look at the budget and going forward, and if you were going to look at a financial pinch that you're experiencing because of what you'd done in the past. What we're currently experiencing is a financial pinch because of what we did in the past. And families don't talk about whether they're going to pay their bills or not in the same sentence in which they talk about how they're going to economize in the future. They pay their bills and they talk about how they're going to economize in the future so they don't have the similar kind of bill to pay going forward. But that's not the way we're going at it. And it, you know, if families would sit around the table and if their lenders could hear them talking about how it is that they weren't going to pay their bills and how it is that they had various bills that they wouldn't pay and they were picking and choosing what bills to pay, they'd have a lot of trouble borrowing money, okay? And so we should understand that the world out there is the lender to the federal government. The world out there is listening and watching to what's going on. And the notion that we would flirt with the consequences of not paying the bills for the things that we already bought, the things we already agreed to do, is outrageous.
Well, Sandy, I watched Janet Yellen on Meet the Press yesterday with
Yellen.
Chuck Todd.
Yellen.
What did I call her?
You Scandinavianized
what
her.
What did I call her?
Yellen.
Oh, okay. What is the name again?
Yellen.
Yellen, okay. So I stand corrected. But I watched her yesterday on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. And he asked, what would you pay if, let's say, the debt ceiling was not raised of the bills that are out?
Yeah, which bills would you pay?
And she was trying to go through this litany of what bills you would have to pay. But I ask you, what point is trying to be proven? I was listening to, again, McCarthy and Republicans say, we have to cut our spending and we've got to do it now, right now. We've got to cut the... So what's to be proved by that, and why is it right this moment?
Well, I mean, it's just leverage. It's just like, okay, the proof is, you know, we're not going to take a promise. We need something done today, right now. But, you know, and Janet Yellen, the answer to that question is complex, because the federal government and the executive could make decisions about not paying bills other than, so they could avoid paying bills to some employees, they could avoid paying and still pay still service the debt, okay? But that would involve a whole lot of discretion that should be in the hands of either Congress or the executive as to how money doesn't get spent that has already been authorized to be spent. And so the Federal Reserve, by looking at its own kind of constitutional, or at least from the standpoint of the laws enacting it, what kind of authority does it have? It tends to look at just monetary policy and not fiscal policy. So if it restricts itself to monetary policy issues, it comes down to really, does it pay the debt or not? And so I'm sure Janet Yellen struggled to answer the question. I'm sure she talked about that issue as to the question of the range of authority that the Treasury has for not paying bills. You know, can they just not pay the military? Can they not pay some other bill pending and still pay for the and still pay their interest?
Well, she said clearly interest, military, Social Security. These are things that they don't have any choice but to pay.
Right.
And she even talked about contractors.
Well, they've got contracts, so there's restrictions on the ability of the government to impair contracts. It's all very fuzzy because there have been periods where there has been pay. I mean, at the state level, we've seen it happen, right? With pay suspensions and with pay reductions across the board to try and meet the budget. At the federal level, we haven't gotten to that point because we've always in the nick of time solved this problem.
So how then, Sandy, which I don't understand how they project a loss of 10 million jobs if these things happen and all of these things, and it's going to trigger a recession.
Well, the recession is what loses the jobs, and the negative impact on the economy is what loses the jobs. But, you know, the diminishment of the reputation of the United States in the financial markets will have a long-term effect on America, on the primacy of the American dollar and world currency. I mean, here we are using the dollar as a weapon with respect to all the sanctions that we're doing. We're sanctioning various countries. We're sanctioning China. China's a huge economy. So we're to some extent threatening the dollar's primacy by using it as a weapon. And then we're threatening its primacy by flirting with insolvency at the federal level. So, you know, we are taking for granted this sort of supreme position of the United States in the world economy. We're taking it for granted, and then we're toying with it and playing with it and threatening it.
So we've got to go to a break. Phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That means Monday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be back. So, Sandy.